I'm glad to be here, actually, this morning. I had my doubts when I left the house. We live over in the Aspinwall, Fox Chapel area. So the roads were fine. It was better than my wife anticipated. So I was glad that the news she had on her cell phone was not correct. So it worked out fine. The other thing I wanted to mention also is that I hope that Westminster Presbyterian Church, which I'm very fond of, realizes that its mission is far from being over. You've made some great strides, and I'm just hoping that you might catch on to something else as we talk. And one of the things which I, in keeping with today's presentation, is the need for us not just simply to be united as a country, but to be united as Christians and to be united in God's sight, because that's what the biblical passport is all about, to realize that we are created in God's image. Genesis 1, 26 and 27, that we are created in God's image. And that has all kinds of implications for us. And we need to keep that in mind, because I'm afraid that sometimes our understanding of the Christian faith is too tribal. It's too narrow. And it reflects more our biases than what God is thinking. And none of us really, we can only approximate how God thinks. We're finite. We're not going to make it ourselves. But two people who have put some of their minds to this in different ways is a professor at Harvard, whose background I think is essentially Presbyterian. I've had a chance to meet him. And I also heard him lecture at the University of Pittsburgh. I think he came really because his daughter's on the faculty there. And he wrote a book with another professor from Notre Dame. And the two of them, one Protestant in background, one Catholic in background, wrote this particular book, American Grace. I really want you to read this book. Now, you might be overwhelmed because that's so many pages. Just read it quickly. But some places you're going to read more than others, because the book is really a series of stories on us and our diversity. And in the context of that diversity, these two men of faith, one is named Robert Putnam, the Protestant, and the other is David Campbell, the Catholic. And they have both been here, and they have not only lectured at the University of Pittsburgh, but they actually, I heard them twice there that day, because I was on the faculty as myself as a visiting professor. They spoke actually to the Katz Graduate School of Business, to the faculty at lunch, and then to the a larger audience of students again. And then that evening, they also were co-opted by the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette has a program from month to month. Not from month to month. Sometimes it's maybe a month and a half apart or more. And that program, they just had a meeting. Maybe some of you were there on diabetes. They talk about different issues. And this last issue was on the diabetes crisis, ending the epidemic. In the meeting, they move around, and they have it in different places. And downtown in the August Wilson Center is where they had their last meeting. They've had it in the big Heinz History Center, many of their center meetings, and they've had it also at the stadium, the Rooney Auditorium there. Well, we went to this one, Healthcare Forum on Diabetes. And my wife and I, it's really a very fine program. And the editor, David Shreveman, is the moderator for these programs. Why am I taking time to share this with you? Because I have a crazy brain idea of Westminster Church being involved in a parallel kind of event. How could you be involved? I don't see why you couldn't put on the Westminster seminars that you're doing now in a systematic way throughout Allegheny County. In other words, plan maybe quarterly, four times a year, to have your Westminster seminars held and move around regionally in the Allegheny County. It would be the Westminster seminars, and it would be broadcasted through the Pittsburgh Presbytery and through Pittsburgh Seminary. And it would seem to me that it could be a very outreaching kind of program, so that eventually you're going to lead to something even bigger. Westminster Presbyterian Church can be the major parent in developing maybe at least four regional places in Allegheny County that are centers of lifelong learning. The trouble Christians have is we stop learning. We think we graduate from the church. You know, oftentimes the service of initiation and becoming a member of a congregation for a young person is their graduation service. That's when they begin to start to drop out. Parents don't stop pushing them to go to church, and they drop out. And we have the biggest dropout rate as Christians that you can imagine. That's why you had that particular study at the Pew Foundation made that I passed out to you. We aren't the most religious country in the world. We're kidding ourselves if we keep putting that in the back of our minds. We're at midpoint. We're around the nations that are more religious and less religious, and we're already in the midpoint. We're about 51%. We're far from being where we think we are. We're not as far as down the hill as Donald Trump is. And we're not really as far up the hill as Jimmy Carter was and is. I mean, his Bible study classes are the main tourist attraction when you go down into Georgia. Now, all I'm trying to say here is that if you had a church such as this church has and its resources and its talents, starting Westminster seminars, can have them four times a year. They will grow into maybe turning one of the churches we're closing down into a center for lifelong learning. You see what I'm trying to get at? I mean, I was reading the story, just scanned the paper today, about the congregations that Bishop Zubik is having to close, and the agony of the Catholics who have been there for generations with their families, knowing that they can't pay the bills anymore. They've got to close these congregations. Why not be more creative about it and turn some of the churches that we have been thinking about closing to, not give them a slow death, but give them a revival, and turn them into a center of lifelong learning? Because if we do that kind of thing, you'll realize what Putman and Campbell are trying to say in their book, American Grace. The subtitle is How Religion Divides and Unites Us. How Religion Divides and Unites Us. And you are united when you go through these experiences of a center of lifelong learning. You never graduate. God didn't create us to graduate. And I think we have to get out of that kind of mentality. God created us to keep on growing. And if whatever your idea of heaven might be, and there are many different ideas about people have about heaven, Hopefully, one idea that will prevail is that we will deepen our growth. We will deepen the sense in which we are really united, that we are really created in God's image, and that we are all connected. We already know that we're connected. We try to work on that pretty hard in economic terms. And we fight it on immigration terms. We need to begin to put ourselves together here. And we need to sort of, you know, have a seminar course on reviving the Statue of Liberty and its spirit that is behind this country and that the French realized long ago and wanted to say thank you to us. And I think we need to really begin to open this up. This is beyond politics. This really comes to trying to do the will of God. And you pray for the will of God every time you pray the Lord's Prayer. You already have it memorized. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. The biblical understanding of life for us is to realize that what Jesus does for us is uniting earth and heaven together. Uniting earth and heaven together. And this is, I think, the kind of dream that will revive us as a Presbyterian church. This will be the kind of dream that will help young people to realize that they never really make it in life completely. And this will also help us who oftentimes spend a lot of time worried about, we better tell so-and-so about what's involved if they don't accept Jesus. And we worry about those people. We ought to be worried about ourselves. Because we say we accept Jesus, but we try to do everything against his will often. Because it suits our biases. It suits our pocketbook. It suits our love-hate kind of relationships that we have. The truth is that Jesus is really in the business of reconciling us to God. And we have to be in the same business. If we aren't, we're missing the boat here. I mean, think about it for yourselves. American grace, realizing how religion divides and unites us. And you know what really woke these folks up? Each of them and their family had somebody they loved very much. But the person they loved very much was not a Christian. The person they loved very much was an aunt in the family. And how did that person become an aunt? Through intermarriage. In the case of one of them, Robert Putman, the person was of Indian background. But everybody loved this particular aunt. Let's call her Aunt Sue. They couldn't have for the world imagined Aunt Sue not making it to heaven. Heaven wouldn't be heaven for them if Aunt Sue wasn't there. And yet Aunt Sue went to her temple as well as going to the Christian church. And too, Aunt Sue had a certain allegiance to her heritage. And she wanted to be faithful to it. But she had understood a larger picture. We can't get into a narrow box. We don't want to be a part of a truck full of discontented Christians. And we have a lot of that around today. People who are basically church dropouts. Often dropping out after they have passed their, and they have their sheet. They went through their commencement. They went through their teenage years and they became a member. And they wrote down their statement of faith. You ever read these statements of faith when they go to these communion classes to have their first communion? Think about it. And yet, as Presbyterians, we know that our church permits us to baptize infants. Who are a member through your baptism. And we have to begin to realize how God works, not how we work. When we pray, thy will be done, not ours, on earth as it is in heaven. So that is, I think, important. And I thought to myself, you know, Pittsburgh is known for its sports teams. Pittsburgh is known for its health care for people. But is Pittsburgh really known for the people of faith who unite people? I don't know about that. There was one Episcopalian way before your time and mine who was here, who was at Calvary Presbyterian Episcopal Church, and his name was Sam Shoemaker. You've heard the name. He had the dream. He wanted to bring people together to realize they need to keep working on being together. That's learning. Usually when we're unhappy, we walk away. I talked to a particular woman who we're good friends with the whole family. I won't mention their name because most of you will know them. But she said to me, "Boy, I'm quitting Fox Chapel Presbyterian Church." I said to her, "Why?" "Well, I tell you the truth," she said, "it speaks up a little too many times on the issue of the tension between Palestinians and Israelis. And I have a number of Israeli or Jewish persons who are my clients. And they're unhappy with the Presbyterian Church holding up its stock like we did in the apartheid issue. Because the South Africans who were fighting apartheid told us, please, as a church, we are the ones who will suffer if you pull your stock, hold back your stock. And because we want to send a message to these big companies that we want life to change here in South Africa." And that divided a lot of Presbyterians. People didn't want to see the church into politics. The church is basically seems to be oftentimes in the business of hurting relationships, not building relationships. And what we need to ask ourselves is, we're also sometimes in the business of doing our will and not God's as well. And so the idea is, how do we bring this all together in our lives? Well, the kind of pieces that you have that I'm giving out to you are all along those lines. One that you have right now, since we are in a market-driven society, probably the most ecumenical thing that goes on today in our lives is going to, whether you're on a trip abroad or going into a busy marketplace here at home, going down to the strip district, is the most ecumenical thing a lot of us do. Seeing all the different people from different nationalities having their stores or selling their food that they've cooked right there on the outside. And people look forward. You go down to the strip district, it's packed on a weekend. Well, the point is that the marketplace shouldn't be the only place where we really get together. People in the marketplace are really glad that we have immigrants here in America because they enjoy all the mixed. You know, and maybe you've looked on TV on the program of the fellow who takes people on tours around the world and they see the different food and go and they taste it. And I'm trying to think of his name, who leads travel tours. I mean, I would like to be on his next trip that he takes to go for all the different kinds of cheese. I mean, we are all enriched by each other. That's what it means to unite. Well, what would be the Ten Commandments for the marketplace? This is one of the ideas that for you to think about. This is not talking about the Ten Commandments exactly in Scripture. That's why sometimes, instead of putting Ten Commandments, I sometimes say Ten Guidelines for the marketplace. But people in business tell me they like the word commandments, Ten Commandments, because that's still a branded name, a branded title that people can use in their lives. And I've noticed some businessmen who, one fellow told me, who's in the real estate business, I just put that up to remind myself when I sell a piece of property or buy a piece of property. How am I to treat one another? Another very good friend of mine who's a psychoanalyst, we're good friends, and you probably know him for some of his works. And his name is Michael Maccabee. He's the son of a rabbi and the grandson of a rabbi. And he's a graduate of Harvard, actually. But more important, he writes books that people read. And one of his books that he's written is really the importance of us to begin to find out who we are. And if you go to his house in D.C. and have breakfast with him in the morning, he has a plaque, the Ten Commandments in the major religions of the world. They're stated a little differently, but it really comes down to being the same. And we have to think about that. What are the implications of that for ourselves? Well, those are some of the things there that I wanted you to look at. I'm going to ask Eric now read for us why we do this. You can find this particular reading said in different ways in different books and epistles in the Old and the New Testament. But he's going to read something from 1 John. And it's 1 John, the fourth chapter, and a little, and some of the fifth. Eric, why don't you stand up so they can all hear you?
Sure. God is love. And those who abide in love abide in God. And God abides in them. Love has been perfected among us in this, that we may have boldness on the day of judgment. Because as He is, so are we in this world. There is no fear in love. The perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment. And whoever fears has not reached perfection in love. He loves because he first loved us. Those who say, I love God, and hate their brothers or sisters are liars. For those who do not love a brother or sister whom they have seen cannot love God, whom they have not seen. The commandment we have from him is this. Those who love God must love their brothers and sisters also. Everyone who believes that Jesus is the Christ has been born of God. And everyone who loves a parent loves a child. By this we know that we love the children of God, and we love God and obey his commandments. For the love of God is this, that we obey his commandments. And his commandments are not burdensome, for whatever is born of God conquers the world. And this is the victory that conquers the world, our faith. Who is it that conquers the world but the one who believes that Jesus is the Son of God?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, it's amazing that you... the kind of writing that John is saying here and others that were following Jesus, that you really can't accept God's love without also communicating your love for one another. You can't love God without loving others, because we are all created in God's image. Jesus is the personification of love. And the power of love is so great that we are unable to really absorb it. And when I'm trying to help us to understand, I think Eugene Peterson in The Message makes it very clear. If anyone boasts, I love God, and goes right on hating his brother or sister and thinking nothing of it, he's a liar. If he won't love the person he can see, How can he love the God he can't see? The command we have from Christ is blunt. Loving God includes loving people. You've got to love both. Brings to mind an experience I had. A family was losing the senior member of the family. He was dying from cancer, and they asked me if I'd come to the hospital. The family was going to be gathered. And this big brother, father to the whole family, wanted to be present and wanted to have everyone present. And they held hands. And they had a prayer together. And then he said, as he looked to his number two, his brother, he said, "Everything's being passed on to you. I want you to hold the family together." They were a very wealthy family. And when the will was read, the family was split. And the wish of the senior member of the family who was dying, if he'd known what was going to happen, it was contrary to what he wanted. It's not that money is evil, really. We know that from Scripture. It's the love of money instead of the love of each other. Evil resides in our actions. Now, John, I'm correct, right? It's John. John gave me a note the other day. I was trying to find it, John. I have it here in my folder, but I don't want to take the time to look for it. But this is what John was saying. Well, you say it for yourself. If Christianity and Christ are not to be seen as the same thing, right? Then the second point of your statement was that, you say it.
I have to remember. Okay, let me think. If we equate Christ with Christianity, we're wrong.
If we equate Christ with Christianity, it's wrong.
Christ would not uphold everything that fits into Christianity. I don't remember the second half of it. Do you have it? This is something I asked last week.
Right. Right, here. And I thought you had that down pat, and I just thought to myself, I don't have an answer for that. But what you were saying really was that the... let me see. Here it is. Your writing, you know, my writing is bad, but you're not far behind.
Oh boy. Two ideas. Christianity and Christ, they're not the same thing. Christ is more authentic than Christianity. The Spirit of Christ had a part in inspiring the great religions, all great religions, all of them. The Spirit of Christ was in all religions, is what I'm proposing.
Right.
So if these two things are true, should we not be able to communicate better with all the religions?
Right. Well, see, I think that you're putting your hand really on a point that a lot of people would like to cover up. But the point is that what you're really saying isn't so much comparing the Christ and the inspiration Christ gives with all the other religions, because they feel there are other prophets. I mean, even the Muslims feel that Jesus is a prophet, but they have their prophets too. And they feel that their prophets do inspire them. They may attribute parts of it to Jesus, but parts of it they don't.
Here's my problem. I'm thinking of Christ, not Jesus, the historical
okay.
Jesus.
Right.
There's a Spirit of Christ that John 1 says was there before everything. The Word was...
Okay. Well, see, that's really where a lot of seminary education rests, struggling with this issue. And struggling with the issue was there is the Jesus of history, and there is the Christ of faith. Are they really the same?
No.
See, that's what you're raising. See, you were already a senior at Pittsburgh Seminary, if you got that far. Now, the point is, where do we go from there? Where do we go from there? And that's where you have these various ecumenical councils. And every time there's been an ecumenical council, I have a historian in the pew here, and I know he'll correct me afterwards. But the point is, every time you've had an ecumenical council, you've also had a division. Particularly, for example, when I think about my studies among the Eastern Christians. But it's also true whether you're talking about Roman Catholics. For example, if you're among the Eastern, some people say Eastern Orthodox, but actually they're all really a part of Eastern Christianity. In fact, even the Christian faith is more Eastern than it is Western. We sometimes forget that part. But we know, for example, the Council of Nicaea, because we study that. But actually, there are three councils at the very beginning. And these early councils in the early centuries, many felt that that was sufficient. And Eastern Christians were a particular group. They are, for example, like the Coptic Christians, the Armenians. There's a number of groups. But there was another group of Eastern Christians or Eastern Orthodox that felt, no, we got to go on further. And they went up to seven councils, from three to seven. The first group said three was enough. Others went up to seven. Then the Catholics said, you know, seven isn't enough. And when they had the famous Vatican II gathering, they were already up to their 22nd council meeting. There's a sense in which we are good at dividing ourselves. But we're not as good in following the example of Jesus. And when we follow the example of Jesus, we follow a combination of the Jesus of history and the Jesus of, and the Christ of faith. So what I'm trying to say here is that, in broad strokes, this really bothered one of our presidents. Perhaps in some ways, one of our most intelligent presidents, Thomas Jefferson. And so Thomas Jefferson was a man of more than one language. He had been an ambassador for us before he was our third president. He had been in France. He knew French. He understood Greek. He understood English, of course, and he understood Latin. And so he gathered a sample of at least two copies of Scripture in those languages. And he put them on his shelf, and he said in particular, I really want to know more about this Jesus of history and his moral leadership that he gave. But I don't want to be caught so much with the Christ of faith. Because that seems to be influenced a lot by the Apostle Paul and John and Peter. And I don't want a lot of that. That crowds the picture. They're putting words in Jesus' mouth. But he only talked so frankly with his close friend that he got separated from. And then got united a year or two before both of them died on the same date. If I believe correctly, it was the 4th of July. And namely, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. Well, what happens then? Adams, who was a more traditional Christian, who had the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith, and Thomas Jefferson, who really wanted the Jesus of history, his moral leadership, And so he began to work on a project. He, you might say, was working on the first biblical passport, if you want to put it that way. I don't want you to think of it that way, but let's say for the moment you're doing it. It's that way. And but he became president, and he was too busy. And he had other things on his mind, and his whole project was on the shelf. But as he and Adams got reunited, Adams said to him, Thomas, you've got to finish this project that you're working on. The American people will appreciate it in time, even though I don't agree with you on it altogether. And so as he stepped down from presidency, he began to work. And that's what you got next. You have the Jefferson Bible. Now, the point is, this Jefferson Bible is really very interesting when you read it. But traditional Christians won't accept it. It's not taught as a course at a seminary. But you can read it. And you can. And what he did was, his biblical passport, you know, this was the days before computers. This was his creative mind working. It was a scissors and paste job. It wasn't the scissors and paste on the computer. It was doing it and putting a book together. And he put together the words he thought Jesus really said. The underlining, the red underlining, if you will. And he created his Jefferson Bible. You might find it rewarding to read and to look at. Or you might want to, I think you have here a place where you can pick up a book that gives you a couple histories of that. And with Forrester Churchill writing the Gospel According to Thomas Jefferson, see, it's on the back part of this page, the table of the text he used, the life and morals of Jesus of Nazareth, Jefferson and his contemporaries by the well-known Yale professor of history, Pelican, and then the extracts. And you can see it for yourself. See, the trouble is, a lot of us really aren't as original as we think we are. When we start to look at things, we find that things have already been said earlier. We may accept or reject it depending on where we are in our heads. But I don't think Jefferson was so much. He realized that if people really knew what he was doing, he wouldn't get their vote for another term. Well, Adams advised him, just do it quietly. It'll come out in history. It'll come out and it'll be known what you're contributing. Somehow we grew up with the idea that if we couldn't be the religion that wins in the end, why be a Christian?
Can I say one thing?
Yeah.
I don't agree with Jesus of history and then Jesus of faith being the one I'm talking about.
Right.
Neither. I'm talking about the Christ that was here before everything. In John 1, the Word was here in the beginning.
Right.
That's the Jesus. That's the Christ I'm thinking of.
Right. And I'm taking you behind.
Not the historical one, and then not the one that
right.
we all created.
Right.
Those are three Jesus. The one that really inspired all religions is the one that was here before the Big Bang.
Right.
That Christ was here. And that Christ inspired all religions. All. But they articulated these what they came up with in different ways. And it was through different prophets, but that's what I'm referring to.
Right, and even though there, for example,
and
John, even before John 1:1, even before that, when you go to the creation stories, there's more than one, you know, in Genesis.
Right.
But when you read them both, but there's a sense in which Jesus,
Christ,
the Spirit. The Father, they're all in this mystery.
Absolutely.
We use the word Trinity, but I think you might be surprised if I told you the word Trinity doesn't appear in the Bible.
Well, wouldn't that Christ that was there have inspired the religions of King Lever, like Islam,
right.
Buddhism,
well,
all of them?
Yeah, that's your imaginative thinking, and you may or may be correct, you may not. The point is that you're thinking. And what I want us to do is think. Think, but don't think dogmatically. Think creatively. And that's what you're doing, John. Think creatively. Let's not be fearful of our thinking. As I told you that story from my first session, the pastor who said to me, he looked at me in the face, here I was, a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old, whatever I was at that point, in late my adolescent years. He said, you have too many questions. Where's your faith? And I said, what does that mean? He said, you don't try to find all these answers. You can't find them. Just have faith. Well, see, that doesn't satisfy a person who has an inquiring mind, as most creative youngsters have. And so what we want to do is encourage creativity with curiosity. That's how we grow. That's what it means to be a center of lifelong learning. And not to be fearful when someone comes up in the family with some radical idea that you know is off the wall. Work with the person. Why did they come up with that idea? Where's it going to go? What are the consequences? And talk. Let's not be fearful as Christians as we grow. I think what we are really oftentimes is fearful of these people of many different backgrounds who not only have the skills creatively to do things that we marvel at, but who in many ways outdo us in deeds. Here it was Luther who was completely uncomfortable with the Epistle of James, who said, really, words without deeds don't mean much. Words without love doesn't mean much. Love is essentially a deed. It's not a word. And we want to move in that direction. Yeah, John, go ahead.
What? I heard a proposal one time that was very much in line with what you're talking about. And it said we should turn the church services over into discussions and not have a preacher doing a monologue, exegeting scripture or something. What would you say about that? Turn the church services into discussions.
Right. Well, actually, we have groups that do that. One was, for example, in the 1870s. When I mentioned to you our president who was elected, James Garfield. James Garfield was an ordained minister in the Disciples Church, the Christian Church. But it was really more of a group that came and studied together in Washington. He was never a pastor of a church. He was actually a general in Lincoln's army in the Civil War. But the point is, he was a part of the Disciples Church that does that kind of thing, if you will. But even more so are the Quakers. You gather as believers in silence. That's one group of Quakers. And you have another group of Quakers. You gather together to talk and to hear talks with each other. I mean, before you know it, you're going to talk me out of my work. But the point is that sermons really are designed, hopefully, to raise questions. Because people have more questions about God than they have answers. And there are a lot of people at a gravesite who have these questions. And they want to have a comfort level where they can raise these with their pastor. But if their pastor is too dogmatic, or if their pastor is too judgmental, if they raise some questions, you say, well, what would the group think of me if I say this? And I find, you know, that oftentimes we wonder about these things. I know, for example, one couple, for example, that went to a half a dozen more churches to hear me preach to see whether or not I was consistent before they were going to make any contribution to the seminary. I'm glad I never knew about it. I heard about it after I retired. But that was their... They had some deep skepticism about anybody who was in the pulpit. But they didn't want to come out and raise it that way because it would reflect on them. They simply went on their own quiet way and made sure that I didn't see them, and that's why I never knew about it. Afterwards, when you shake hands with people, they slipped away. And the thing is that we want to know, just like John was saying that he wanted to know that Jesus and what he said was authentic. People are in search of authenticity. And oftentimes we don't discover the authenticity of a person until after they die. So I've taken you a long way here. I don't know, how much time do I have, Sarah?
You have about 7 minutes.
Okay, good. Okay, let's go with your questions. But before you go your questions, let me tell you two other things. Because since we're in Advent, a week away from Christmas, and even though every year Christmas begins a week earlier for the business community. You know, the Christmas decorations come up toward the end of September. And before we know it, you know, we say, let's put Christ back into Christmas. Well, I'm not sure that's exactly what you want to do. But the point is, we are in a market-driven world. And whether that world is united or not, we're still going to go to the marketplace. We're still going to buy and sell. And you're going to do that no matter who's your president, no matter who is your senator or congressperson or whatever. Well, I got to thinking about all that, and then I came across this article this past week that a conservative group has me on their mailing list. You'd be surprised. I'm more conservative than you realize in a lot of ways. And this group says that religion contributes this past year $1.2 trillion to society. And then I saw where they got their information, and we looked it up on the computer. And I printed out this report, 60-page report, by a well-known group that analyzes how churches give and how the revenue adds up. And the whole point of the article is that we are a major contributor. Now, this will be news, I think, to Trump, who sort of graduated from church a long time ago. In fact, he doesn't feel he's at all in the business of forgiveness. But see, you don't love without forgiving. Think about it. We all get hurt by each other. And if we don't learn how to forgive, we really can't love. Well, the point is that this contribution that the churches make is to show its impact. And the reality is that you have the contemporary church and you have the traditional church. But usually most of the money still is in the hands of the traditional church. And the truth is that money in itself isn't the last word. Well, okay. I got to thinking about that, and then I said, what is the business of religion? Of any religion, not just Christianity. What is the business of religion? And then I twisted it around the other way as I was working on my book. And what is the religion of business? There's the business of religion, and there is also the religion of business. What is it that the person in the marketplace will fight for? Isn't it their fair share of the business? We don't like, for example, being done out by the Chinese or any other country, with whether it be steel or whatever it might be. We want a fair marketplace. There's the religion of business, and there is the business of religion. And what does Christmas represent? Does it represent what the advent of Jesus is all about? Forgiving love from God the Father? And what is business all about? Is it really business really trying to put food on everyone's table? One way or another to help? You know who the most charitable people are in the life of a seminary? After my 25 years at the presidency of the seminary? People from business. Many others had terrific rhetoric on the seminary. They could tell me a lot of things that were great, but they weren't around when we needed them. In fact, I had one funny person who, he was really an older man, he was in his 90s, and he made a point every year of calling me up on a Saturday, and I was at home. And he'd call me up and he would say, "I'm here at the seminary, Sam, and I got a check here for X thousands of dollars, and nobody's around and the doors are closed. What kind of business are you in?" And I get in the car and I go down to the seminary, and there he was waiting for me. And he'd give me the check. Well, he was serious about what he did. He later endowed a chair. Not completely, but quite a bit to the seminary. But I'll never forget the time I went and called on him at his place. He lived on a farm. He said to me, "I haven't got any time to talk with you in sitting down." He says, "Hop on the tractor. I'm going to ride you through the orchard." And he says, "And I want to show you how I make my living." That's great. I was learning. And I was giving him respect by being on the tractor, praying that I wouldn't fall off. No, that's how we learn. That's how we grow. We become a team. And so then a fellow came out with a book called The Religion Business. And the religion business is really it's really not just simply the people who sometimes have these TV stations on radio, and you know them as well as I do, who are always asking for money. And then you find out that they're living a life that you wonder about afterwards. Where was that? Why were I giving to these people? And there are others, frankly, the religion business is a business that has a lot of hurt. And they're there for people when they need them. The religion business is really a business of forgiveness and healing. And that's really why theology and medicine, law, actually the people who are in business, who have a spirit of charity, they all work together as a team. So I'm just trying to whet your appetite about how to look at things in a larger picture. Well, my time is up, but what I'm hoping for is that you'll create your own with the writers' club that you have here at the church, and get together and work on this biblical passport. And send me a sample when each of you have worked something out so that we can look at it and see it for ourselves. Where are we going? What do we really believe? How do we really want to be remembered? And I think that's enough for now. But Sarah gave me the warning. But listen, Sarah, I want all of us to say thank you to you and to Ted for all the work and all the copy work I've asked you to do. Thank you very much.